Then we will call Martin versus Administrator, New Jersey State Prison. We have Mr. Brown and Ms. Sullivan here with us. So Mr. Brown, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Great, thank you. And may it please the court. Micah Brown for the appellant, Micah Brown Deckard LLP, on behalf of the appellant Selwyn Martin. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the case today is about comity, finality, and federalism. Those core principles that undergird AEDPA require federal habeas courts to give great deference to the decisions, both substantive and procedural, of state courts while they're adjudicating petitioners' habeas petitions. It would be incompatible with those principles to turn AEDPA into a one-way ratchet that awards deference to state courts when they rule against petitioners on procedural points, but conducts de novo review on the rare occasion when a petitioner has won a procedural determination before the state court.
But counsel, why is it really de novo review if what we're looking at is the nature of the out-of-time relief that was granted by the state court? And looking at the as-within-time relief as it's been applied by the state courts here, why shouldn't we simply view that as, you know, a sort of equitable tolling where if they make the decision that they're going to revise something after the fact, it's still out of time. And so it's not pending during that interim period, even if they're calling it as within time rather than using a Latin phrase to describe that.
Your Honor, so and I want to make sure I understand your question. You're asking essentially why it can revive the pendency, a later determination of timeliness?
I mean, in effect, isn't that what the state courts here, when they're giving this as within time relief, it's simply a non-proton kind of relief that doesn't indicate that a matter is actually pending during that time. It's resuscitating it, but just because they've decided to call it as within time doesn't convert it from something untimely that they've then decided to move forward with into something that was actually timely.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's a distinction here between curing untimeliness and holding the petition to be, or the appeal, I should say, to be timely, and issuing a decision on the merits despite the untimeliness. And I think there's a clear distinction in the law there, and I think what the court here did, and I take your point about, well, if they had just used a different phrase, if they just called it nunk-pro-tunk, I think that the New Jersey courts have a procedure to declare an appeal, an otherwise untimely appeal, as within time. And that if that's the language...
That doesn't seem to be answering the question, though, Mr. Brown. The question is, we're looking at 2244D2. That's the operative provision in AEDPA that we've got to pay attention to, and it says that the time during which a properly filed application for state post-conviction or other collateral review with respect to the pertinent judgment or claim is pending shall not be counted toward any period of limitation under this subsection. So the question for us isn't, you know, so much whether New Jersey decides it wants to bring a claim back from the dead, which is what happened here. It was not timely under their own post-conviction relief statute, and they chose to say, okay, we're going to let you bring it back. Now, the question, and if this isn't Judge Krause's question, I apologize to her, but it's a question I've got. I think it's her question. How does the fact that they choose to resurrect a claim say anything to whether it was pending during the years and years that passed when it wasn't pending? It was an out-of-time claim. It was dead. It wasn't there. How does that constitute pending within the meaning of 2244D2?
Your Honor, we know from the case law that an appeal or a petition is is timely and properly filed if the rules of that state and the state courts say it is. And if we're going to give AEDPA deference to timeliness, well, pending is just the flip side of timeliness. If it's really
pending is a completely different word, right? You can say something, they can say, we choose to treat this as timely, but the fact that they choose to treat it as timely doesn't change the historical fact that it was not pending. Pending has a meaning in the English language, and it means existing in fact during that period. And it was not existing in fact during that period. I mean, how do we get from we choose to treat this as timely in the state court to, as a federal matter, it was pending the whole time? Inconsistent with the historical record here.
Your Honor, pending includes the time of the action from the filing to the completion, and the Supreme Court has allowed that, you know, for example, in the Jimenez case that the court brought to our attention on Monday, certainly in the direct appeal context, it can restore the pendency. A later state court determination to hear an appeal as within time can restore the period of pendency.
What relevance does that finality under Jimenez have for our assessment here on the post-conviction proceeding and whether it's pending for purposes of AEDPA?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think Jimenez is, as I noted, I don't think it's exactly directly on point because that dealt with restoring the pendency of
D1.
Direct appeal.
And it spoke in D1, right? It was talking to subsection D1, and it was dealing with the question of finality, not the question of pending, right?
Your Honor, yes, that's true. But it did ultimately restore the pendency of a direct appeal.
True, but Jimenez was speaking about finality under D1. We're wrestling with the question of pending under D2. Aren't those two separate questions?
I take Your Honor's point. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that ultimately a federal habeas court has to give that deference, and that the timeliness, giving deference to the timeliness determination without giving deference to the pending determination isn't really giving full epideference.
So I take your point. You're focused on the interest in comedy and giving full effect to the state court's view. But we're also concerned with that, as you mentioned at the outset, with finality. And when we're looking at what Congress intended in the term of something being pending during that period, don't we also need to take account of the finality interest and whether something that is untimely but accepted for review by the state court really it can be deemed pending, consistent with that interest in finality?
Your Honor, the interest in finality under AEDPA is meant to protect the integrity of state court proceedings, to preserve them from collateral attack in later federal courts. And to the extent that there's a problem here, I mean, this is a rule that the New Jersey courts have created, that the New Jersey legislature or the New Jersey Supreme Court can correct if they feel that that the argument I'm making were to give too much credit to New Jersey courts. You know, that's within their authority to change, and that's the agency that Congress empowered by AEDPA, and that's the finality that Congress was seeking to protect. And that
are
I believe is the
you
issue.
Are you asking us here to create a circuit split?
I'm sorry?
Are you asking us to create a circuit split?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't believe that from the case law that I have seen, I don't believe that there's another case that deals quite with these circumstances. I believe that this can be distinguished.
Stroyer versus Dormer, the Eighth Circuit case, not counsel pretty directly against what you're asking us to do? That's the case where they specifically, the Eighth Circuit distinguished Jimenez, right?
Your Honor, the difference in the Vermeer case was that that petitioner was granted leave to appeal despite being untimely. It wasn't a cure of an otherwise untimely appeal. It was a grant of basically a permission notwithstanding.
In both cases, the question was, what does the word pending mean? And they said, in effect, it's not pending if it was not in existence, and the fact that the state decides to bring it back doesn't mean that it's pending, right? I mean, isn't that case pretty darn close to what you're asking us to do?
Well, Your Honor, I would distinguish it on the basis that first of all, the Dormier Court never, they didn't have to examine the importance of an appeal notwithstanding untimeliness or a cure of an untimely appeal. And so I would distinguish it on that basis, and that the Dormier decision never had to address that logic, and of course didn't. Whereas the case today, we have an appeal that was timely because the state court cured what would otherwise have been an untimely appeal. And so I would say no.
Is your argument ultimately one that just boils down to the semantics of something being as within time on the one hand, or being called, an allowance for appeal, or notwithstanding untimeliness, or non-pro-tunk in other cases?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, one way to look at it would be that it's about semantics. I think, though, that the words that the state agencies, the very agencies empowered by AEDPA and whose interests are to be protected by AEDPA, the choices that they make are important, and that federal habeas courts need to respect those choices. And if New Jersey wants to have a mechanism allowing an appeal notwithstanding untimeliness, or if they want to have an appeal or a mechanism to hear an appeal as within time, it's incumbent upon federal courts to respect the state's choice in that matter. And as I said, AEDPA can't be a one-way street where every time a petitioner loses
let's accept that for the sake of argument for a minute. And you keep talking about if they want to make an appeal timely. The Molina case that you're leaning on is about direct appeals. We're talking about a post-conviction relief effort here. Do you have anything that indicates that the Molina rule that you want us to adopt actually does operate in New Jersey in the post-conviction relief context?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Now, as you noted, Molina was a direct criminal appeal. And the rules that the court referenced in the letter of Monday also relate to direct criminal appeals. Similarly, the cases, New Jersey cases, State against Jackson and State against O'Donnell address curing a late petition, not a late appeal from a denial of post-collateral relief. And so Molina is not directly on point, you're right, Your Honor, because it deals with a direct appeal rather than a collateral appeal. However, New Jersey courts have fairly routinely relied on Molina to grant as-within-time relief to late appeals from denials of collateral relief. For example, in State against Salter, 2015 Westlaw 644-2342, the New Jersey Superior Court Appellate Division, in very similar circumstances to Mr. Martin, said, although not directly on point, Molina is sufficiently analogous to be applicable, and it granted an appeal as within time. In State against Briston,
would you give us the citation one more time?
Yes, Your Honor. State against Salter, 2015, Westlaw 644-2342. And there's also State against Briston, 2000, Briston, 2012, Westlaw 483-9305, granting the same relief. And in State against Pine, that's PYNE, 2011, Westlaw 678-2860. After conducting a Molina analysis, the court denied relief, but they did rely on Molina in coming to that determination. So, as I said, Molina is not quite directly on point because that deals with a direct criminal appeal rather than an appeal from the denial of collateral relief. However, the rules that Molina cites are appellate rules rather than the rules for a petition for collateral relief, and the New Jersey courts have not been shy in relying on Molina to make a similar determination as they made for Mr. Martin.
Okay. Judge Krause or Judge Restrepo, any further questions for Mr. Brown?
Maybe you could talk briefly about the issue of equitable tolling. where we wouldn't be looking to state law, but simply as a matter of federal law and how we could have, I understand the arguments you've made in your brief about due diligence in terms of the initial outreach to counsel, but what about the intervening years after that, where there's no indication of a further action until the 2012 period?
So, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm having just a little bit of trouble hearing you, but I believe I understand you'd be asking me whether my client was diligent in pursuing his appeals, or was there another element to that question?
Yes, if you can address that part of your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And Mr. Martin made numerous attempts to get a hold of his counsel and the appointed defenders division. The public defender's office, I should say. And as we said in our brief, we're not conceding that he wasn't diligent. He sent, over the years, he sent at least five letters to either his counsel or to the public defender's office. Ultimately, when he couldn't get an answer from anyone, he sent a letter directly to the court, pleading with the court to just send him a copy of the judgment so that he could file a pro se appeal. And then ultimately, when he filed his pro se appeal, in his motion for as within time relief, he relied on the same principles as were espoused in Molina. But Your Honor, as I said, we believe that the real issue here is the lack of deference. We do not concede that he wasn't diligent. We believe he was, but even leaving that aside,
why are we even thinking about deference in that situation? Doesn't Holland tell us that's simply a matter of federal law? We're not deferring to the state's assessment of due diligence at that point, right?
Your Honor, the issue here is that it's a state determination of whether he was timely, whether his appeal was pending, whether it was timely in New Jersey. And the New Jersey courts.
That's a separate question, right? The question that's being put to you is about equitable tolling and whether or not the state chooses to give him a call his appeal timely or not. Isn't the question of whether he was diligent in pursuing his rights strictly a matter of federal law? That is, whether he was diligent or not. That's a question to be determined as a matter of AEDPA, not as a matter of the state law about timeliness, right? We're not talking about finality and timeliness. We're talking about due diligence.
Your Honor, if I could just tie it back in, though, it was a state procedural determination that influenced the outcome of AEDPA, and that whether the state gave him the benefit of the doubt under an equitable tolling principle or under a New Jersey statutory tolling principle or for whatever reason the state used, once the state made that decision, the district court should have deferred to it.
So your argument about due diligence only goes to the issue of whether it's pending or not. You're not making a distinct argument under AEDPA, under AEDPA's own due diligence provision. Is that right?
Your Honor, that's again. It's not a point I would concede, but that's not one of our affirmative arguments in this case.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mr. Brown. We'll have you back on rebuttal, Ms. Sullivan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Maura Murphy Sullivan, New Jersey Special Deputy Attorney General, Acting Assistant Prosecutor, representing appellees. Appellees asked this court to affirm the district court's order with respect to both statutory tolling and equitable tolling. First, in addressing statutory tolling, the period in which an application is pending goes forward, not back, meaning statutory tolling the defendant could be awarded would go from 2012, when he filed his notice of motion, and go forward. Before that, there was nothing pending, so he should not be entitled to statutory tolling for that period.
Does the Carey case have any bearing here on what constitutes pending and what doesn't? The Carey versus Sapple case that your opponents rely on.
What I believe Carey gives us is to say that an application is pending from an adverse determination by the lower court until a timely appeal is filed. Here, there was
right.
Here, there was no timely.
And the state, well, the state declared it timely. Does Kerry, in the face of that, does Kerry say, hey, if the state says it's timely, and so consequently it's pending? Is that the import of Kerry?
Here, I would say that the timeliness determination, the appellate division accepting it as within time, only goes to the properly filed determination under D2 that we're talking about in terms of statutory tolling. So I believe that even though the appellate division accepted it as within time, that's a timeliness analysis as to whether that application or petition or motion was properly filed. It doesn't answer the second question about when it was pending.
Why shouldn't we give that respect to the state court's process? If the state, we want to encourage petitioners to proceed through that process to the extent that it is available before turning to the federal courts. So if it is part of a state process, and here it seems in terms of granting this, you know, as within time relief routinely, where there's the allegation of ineffective assistance having caused the delay in appealing, then why shouldn't we allow that to be litigated through the state courts and defer to their own determination that it is a live matter throughout that whole process to be filed as timely, not allowing it out of time, but actually deeming it timely under state law?
So deference, I think, is given whether it's denied or granted as within time. I think we defer to the state courts in terms of whether it's properly filed. But the fact remains that nothing was pending before the state court, even so much as a motion to excuse that untimely. In those years intervening, there was no motion to pursue his appellate rights and continue to litigate that petition, that post conviction relief matter. There was nothing pending in the interim.
Help me with this language from the Kerry decision. An application is pending as long as the ordinary state collateral review process is in continuance, i.e. until the completion of that process. Is that the Supreme Court telling us that it is pending until it's done?
I would submit that Kerry spoke of whether the issue in Kerry had to deal with the timeliness of that petition. And I don't think anything suggests in Kerry that, for example, its holding in that case talked about pending is from the adverse determination going to a timely appeal. So even in Kerry, it's an example of how federal courts would toll the time from the start of an adverse decision going forward. Here, it would be tolling from the time where he filed his motion going forward. I don't think there's anything that warrants going back 2 years of tolling. And I recognize that this court might have concerns about exhaustion, but I think that's a separate consideration. I think you can both have timely filings in habeas court as well as to have exhaustion. I think they can coexist. And here, you would want petitioners to make timely state court filings in order to exhaust their rights.
Would we be having this discussion if the as within time extension, if you will, that was allowed by the state court was, say, 10 days instead of 10 years?
I think we wouldn't be having that discussion because he'd still be within the 1 year habeas clock. I think the issue
What if those 10 days put him outside the clock for other reasons? If a 10-day delay in filing that was treated by the state appellate court as within time, and they proceed to address it on the merits, and then there's eventually a federal habeas petition, where those 10 days are dispositive as to whether it's within the 1 year or not, would you be making the same arguments?
In terms of statutory tolling, I think that's important that if you're outside, and here defendant is outside that habeas 1 year, whether it's 10 days or 7 years, but here significantly it's 7 years, but his habeas clock expired well before he filed his state motion to file as within time. I think it's the same, the amount of time, but here it isn't a significant period of time. In addition to statutory tolling, he would have been able to argue equitable tolling. So if there were circumstances in which in those 10 days under your example, if something happened, he would still be able to argue for equitable tolling. But in terms of statutory tolling, I think in giving meaning to the habeas statute of limitations of the 1 year, as well as to statutory tolling, I think a reading of that would say, sticking to the guidelines, whether it's 10 years or 7 days, I think the result would be the same.
Well, why doesn't Jimenez have relevance here? If we are going to treat a petition that's coming up within D1 as final, despite these kinds of gaps in time, why doesn't that also inform what we consider pending up until finality?
I think Jimenez talks about finality in terms of 2244 D1 and talking about when the habeas clock starts. I think pendency is a statutory tolling determination as it pertains to a separate part of that statute, 2244 D2. And that talks about pausing the clock. So I think the finality determination that the court was making in that Supreme Court case is different from the statutory tolling argument under the separate section of the statute.
Is there any distinction between the idea of timeliness and the idea of pending? I mean, if something is timely, is it pending? And if your position is that it's not, what case are you pointing to tell us that those things are distinct?
I would argue that timeliness goes to properly filed. I apologize, I don't have those sites offhand to specifically cite that, but I believe that the case law talks about conditions of filing. I don't want to speak to a case that I can't specifically cite right now, but I believe that conditions of filing would go to timeliness, which goes to properly filed. But I believe pendency is just a separate determination. Pendency can flow from timeliness and properly filed. But again, in this case, even if this court were to give statutory tolling to a properly filed motion, even if this court were to give statutory tolling, I believe that it would go forward and not back to say that that petition is pending from the time you filed the motion to file as within time going forward to the appellate division's decision on the merits.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You don't make any distinction there between the as within time relief versus equitable tolling within the state courts?
So I think it's whatever state courts are doing as to equitable tolling, I think is they grant their motions pertaining as to their own purposes of granting, excusing a late filing to address the merits. That I think is separate and distinct from the federal standard in which this court would apply to determining whether to equitably toll the federal habeas statute of limitations. So I think those two decisions are distinct and have different standards.
Would you recognize any exceptions to a rule like that? Say on a federal habeas petition we had before us, a claim that was clearly meritorious, where the state appellate court, having accepted it as within time, had reached a decision that on its face was contrary to the U.S. Constitution. Nonetheless, you would strictly apply this rule to say outside. Although it's within time from the final determination of the state court, it's a timely filing of a federal appeal, that it's not within the 1 year from the expiration of the Supreme Court cert filing in a direct appeal. And that would be the end of the story. No exceptions for as to the merits of the arguments or even actual innocence.
Well, I think that in terms of statutory tolling, we would go by the 1 year EPA clock. We'd start and stop it in an appropriate time for statutory tolling. And then I believe that any other equitable considerations that would have to be made, that would go to equitable tolling argument and not necessarily statutory tolling. If that answers your question, I apologize, Your Honor.
And equitable tolling there, you mean under AEDPA, not as informing what constitutes a pending petition?
In terms of statutory tolling or equitable tolling? I think that the statutory tolling, it discusses properly filed and pending. Equitable considerations, I think, is a separate analysis.
Okay. Any further questions, Judge Krause or Judge Restrepo?
No.
Oh, all right.
Thank you.
Then thank you very much, Ms. Sullivan. Mr. Brown, you reserve 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would point out by just emphasizing the definition of pending under Carey is that until the application has achieved final resolution through the state's post-conviction procedure, by definition, it remains pending. Now, we know that
Hold on just a second, because right in that same vicinity, the court says an application is pending as long as the ordinary state collateral review process is in continuance. What's ordinary about a non-pro-tunk or an out-of-time permission? Isn't that an extraordinary step, not an ordinary step in the post-conviction relief process?
Your Honor, again, I think we have to give deference to the state ruling. The state could have said
That's true. I'm not fighting your premise, which is the state allowed it. And I'm not fighting your premise that we give deference to state decisions like that. I'm trying to engage with you and get you to engage with me on the reliance you're putting on Carey, because you seem to be saying, and I take you to be saying, that Carey tells you as long as the process is going on, you have to say it's pending. But what Carey, the precise language of Carey is, as long as the quote, ordinary state collateral review process is continuing. And so my question to you is this sort of out of time permission, nunk-pro-tunk permission, something that fits within the quote, ordinary state collateral review process, or is it not in fact an exception, something extraordinary that the state allows, but it's not the ordinary state collateral review process?
Your Honor, another great line from Carey is the Supreme Court said that if the California Supreme Court had said that the appellant's 4.5 month delay was unreasonable, that would be the end of the matter. And so whether something is unreasonable or extraordinary, I take Your Honor's point, this was a long delay, but the New Jersey courts, the New Jersey Superior Court Appellate Division didn't say it was unreasonable, didn't say it was extraordinary. They accepted it as within time. And at this point, to say that will give credit to the timeliness determination, but not to the pending determination would make the deference that we give to that New Jersey state court determination hollow. That if we're not going to give deference to it on one, then there's no true epideference in that scenario. And at the end of the day, Your Honor,
Did they ever give a pendency determination? You just, some people might say, hey, you just put the rabbit in the hat there. But when you said you got to give deference to their pendency determination, did the state courts ever make a statement about pendency, or did they only make a statement about timeliness that they would treat it as timely filed?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, as far as I know, there's no explicit determination on the record that it was pending throughout. That being said, if we strip away that pendency, if we take that away from the New Jersey State Court, their ability to restore pendency through an adjudication of timeliness, it's not really epideference. And as I said, Your Honor, epideference should go both ways. And on the rare occasion when it benefits a prisoner or a petitioner, I should say, the petitioner should get the benefit of epideference where warranted. Your Honor, that's why today what we're asking is for a remand for Mr. Martin to have the opportunity to present his habeas petition on the merits.
Okay. I want to thank you, Mr. Brown, and your firm, Deckard, for taking this representation on. It's in the best tradition of the bar. We appreciate that very much, and also appreciate the argument provided by Ms. Sullivan. We've got the case under advisement.